Amen? Thanks, team. Great stuff. Well, good morning. It's good to see you all recovered from Thanksgiving. It's good. Awake. If you have a Bible with you, I'd like to open up one in front of you. Turn to Mark chapter 4 toward the end. That's where we're going to spend most of our time this morning. Now, today we come to what I consider to be one of the most exciting texts in all of Scripture. It has all the components of great story. It's got adventure and drama, high tension, unpredictable twists, mystery, tremendous good guys, really bad, bad guys, human redemption, and ultimately a very satisfying conclusion. In fact, this would make a great movie. We've already got our title. Well, I thought we had our title. There's our title. We got our title. I'm thinking maybe, maybe Bernard Bell is Jesus. We got maybe Brian is Peter. Perhaps John is John. I'm thinking Jack Nicholson for the demon-possessed man on, bring in the heavy hitter for that special part. Well, even more important, though, more important than my movie vision for this passage, this story begs an underlying question with which I'd like us to wrestle today, and it is this. Who is your enemy? When you stop and think about it, who or what do you hold to be your enemy? Everybody's got one or more. Perhaps it'll, like someone around these parts who shall be unnamed, John, it's the University of Oklahoma. For local sports fans, maybe it's the St. Louis Rams, or even worse, the L.A. Dodgers. Even more understandable, maybe it's the Cal Bears. Now that one I can get behind. All kidding aside, though, if we honestly examine our interior world, we can all identify people and or entities we really do consider to be enemies, or at least toward whom we harbor considerable resentment. Perhaps it's an individual who makes our lives miserable at work, at school, in our neighborhood, on a team. Maybe someone in our family who, through abuse, neglect, or abandonment, never gave us the blessing we all so desperately desire. Maybe it's a relative who seems to make every family gathering a miserable experience, perhaps even this past Thursday. Maybe you're like me and you harbor a deep resentment toward certain entities such as the media and what seems to be a determination to undermine all standards of godly living. It could be that business competitor who seems to outflank you at every turn, perhaps using unethical, even immoral tactics to do so. It might even be someone who openly hates you for your faith in Jesus. Whatever your enemy, I want to challenge us today to a new perspective, a new way of thinking about enemies, a new perspective that Jesus was determined to give his disciples, and one I believe he desires to give us also. So let's get into the story in Mark chapter 4. Now, in Mark's account, Jesus has just finished an extended time of teaching, primarily in parables. Everything has been explained to the disciples in private. And now it's time for some field work. Jesus is about to take his guys on a field trip that will rock their world and revolutionize the way they view life. And we are invited to come along, starting in verse 35. On that day, when evening came, he said to them, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd, they took him along with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat so much that the boat was already filling up. Jesus himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he got up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Hush, be still." And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, "Why are you afraid? How is it that you have no faith?" And they became very much afraid and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" So Jesus is exhausted. The time of intensive teaching has left him physically and emotionally spent. So the disciples take him just as he was, and they head to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Now, those living near the Sea of Galilee are familiar with the unpredictability of that body of water and how quickly it can turn frightening. The area is notorious for sudden squalls that come funneling through the hill country of Galilee. Even more violent are the occasional winds from the Golan Heights to the east. Regardless, Jesus and his disciples find themselves in the midst of a fierce gale. Now, what a great scene this is. As the disciples grow increasingly nervous, you can just see him in the boat. Jesus, guys, what do you think? Do we wake him up? Yeah, we wake him up. Jesus, you need to wake up here. We got problems. We got water coming in. We got the boat going down. Do you not care what is happening? I love Mark's care as a writer here. Look how he contrasts the storm with Jesus in verses 37 through 39. It's a wonderful bit of writing. He says it's a fierce gale and the waves are breaking and the boat is filling up. And then look at Jesus. Jesus in the stern, asleep in the cushion, seemingly without care. Now notice how Jesus responds. Be still, he says. Have we seen this before? Can anybody think of where we've seen this before with Jesus? Anybody? Don't make me call on you. Can anybody think, anybody who studied the Gospel of Mark, where we've seen this before? How about chapter 1, when Mark, early on in his Gospel story, tells us of Jesus' encounter with a demon in the synagogue in Capernaum who comes at him screaming. What does Jesus say? He says, be quiet. It's the same word used here. Same word that Jesus uses when quieting the storm on the Sea of Galilee. Phimoo in the Greek, meaning to muzzle or to put to silence. So suddenly we realize that Jesus is not speaking with the wind here. He's not speaking to the waves. He's addressing something far greater. You see, Jesus is exercising his dominion over Satan and his minions. It is the evil one who has thrown up this resistance to Jesus and his disciples. This is more than just a little jaunt across the lake for some R&R. This is an offensive that now takes on a whole new sense of urgency. But there's even more. Mark has additional perspective here that I'm convinced is rooted in the creation, it's rooted in the Exodus, and it's also rooted in Isaiah's vision of a new Exodus, a new and greater Exodus that will be greater than and transcend the original. So I had Brian read that text earlier. Not only are there echoes of Genesis and God's dominion over the chaotic waters in this scene, bringing order from disarray, but we also hear echoes of God's authority as expressed by Isaiah, such as in chapter 43. Isaiah says, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze. So I think Mark sees this event as part of the fulfillment of what Isaiah was speaking of. Isaiah's promise of a new exodus, a new and greater delivery. Let's look at a bit from Isaiah 44. He says, Jerusalem, it shall be inhabited. Of the towns of Judah, they shall be built. And of their ruins, I will restore them. Who says to the watery deep, be dry, and I will dry up your streams. Jerusalem, let it be rebuilt, and of the temple, let its foundations be laid. So you see, Isaiah has a vision of a great restoration, starting with a Redeemer, a great warrior. The warrior would come and he would build a new kingdom, but it would not be an earthly kingdom. It would be a great and new spiritual kingdom. Now, last week, Brian showed us how Moses and Israel reenacted the creation. We saw creation elements all over that Exodus story. Now we see where the story lands. We see that it lands in Jesus himself. And we see that Jesus is reenacting the Exodus. It's the ultimate manifestation now in the Exodus. So Moses and Israel reenacted the creation in the Exodus. Jesus now goes back, reenacts the Exodus, and pulls in a new creation as well, and brings it to its ultimate fruition. Well, how does this work? Let's look a bit more closely. First of all, Jesus departs to cross the sea with his 12 disciples. Where have we crossed the sea before? In Exodus, right? Where have we seen the 12 before? Where do we see the 12? Anybody? 12 tribes, right? This is the new Israel, the new 12 tribes of Israel with Jesus. In the midst of the crossing of the sea, we see that the enemy is neutralized, just as Egypt was neutralized. As all this is transpiring, the faith of the 12 is severely tested, isn't it? Jesus pulls no punches with his men. How is it that you have no faith, he says. Just as Israel was taught faith by Yahweh in a powerful and dramatic way, so the disciples had to be taught faith in the Son of Man. So he's putting his disciples into training, deepening their faith and preparing them for the task ahead of fighting the enemy and evangelizing the world in order to start building his spiritual kingdom. But unlike the first Exodus, Israel is now on the offensive. They are forging ahead into enemy territory in order to effect deliverance. But in order for Israel to be restored and the Exodus to be effected, the strong man must be bound. His silencing here is but a foretaste of what's to come on the other side of the lake. And it goes like this. Chapter 5, starting in verse 1 of Mark. They came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gerasenes. When he got out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. And he had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces. And no one was strong enough to subdue him. Constantly, day and night, he was screaming among the tombs and in the mountains and gashing himself with stones. Seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down before him. So picture this. You're a young Jew. You're following the one who you believe to be Messiah, the one who will deliver Israel from all its oppressors and restore the nation to greatness. As you follow this one and see all the remarkable things that he does, your anticipation grows. You are on the inside. You've been selected to walk with him, to be intimate with him, to be a part of his trusted circle as he ushers in this new era of glory, the long-awaited return from exile for Israel. It must be perplexing enough, however, that the work of this one is being carried out nearly 80 miles from Jerusalem, the center of your spiritual universe and the center of all that is promised Israel in their return to glory. You're a long way away. Now you find yourself pulling up on the beaches of this God-forsaken land, this pagan territory, in a region called Decapolis, or Ten Cities. Now, heading here would be bad enough. But as soon as Jesus and his disciples climb from their boat, they're met by this demon-infested man who lives in a graveyard. If you're a Jew in first century Palestine, there are several things unclean to you, several things you avoid at all costs, lest you be made unclean by them and ostracized from society. Very high on that list would certainly be those who have had such contact with the dead, especially those who are infested by a legion of demons, literally the walking dead. There are few situations that could be more uncomfortable for Jesus' men than this. And it's about to get worse. But before we go there, we need to see what's at the heart of Mark's story here. Once again, he's very carefully crafted this account so that we can't miss the emphasis. And it looks like this. In the very center of Mark's reverse parallel structure, he tells us that no one was able to bind this man. They tried the best tools, the best technology available, and no one was able to do it. Then, in case we didn't get it the first time, Mark repeats himself. Chains and shackles were mere nuisances to this man. No one was strong enough to subdue him. So think again for a moment about this image of binding the strong man. This is another one we've seen elsewhere, isn't it? How about Mark chapter 3, when Jesus is challenged and accused of being in league with Satan? He casts out demons by the power of the evil one, thus explaining his power over evil spirits. Look what Jesus says in reply. He says, "No one can enter the strong man's house and plunder his property unless he first," what? "Binds the strong man. And then he will plunder his house." Look back at verse 3. No one was able to bind him. Suddenly we realize the strong man is about to be bound. One has come who can bind the strong man. The plundering is about to begin. And not only that, images of the Exodus flood this scene. The enemy is at the mercy of Jesus, just like Egypt was at the mercy of Yahweh. The strong man is bound, and Israel is invited to plunder the riches of the enemy. And Jesus is inviting his disciples to the plunder. But what is it? Just how will Jesus bind the strong man? Just what will the plunder be? What will be the result? Verse 7. "And shouting with a loud voice, he said, 'What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God, do not torment me.' For he had been saying to him, 'Come out of the man, you unclean spirit.' And he was asking him, 'What is your name?' And he said to him, 'My name is Legion, for we are many.' And he began to implore him earnestly not to send him out of the country. Now there was a large herd of swine feeding nearby in the mountain. The demons implored him, saying, 'Send us into that swine so that we may enter them.' Jesus gave them permission. And coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them, and they were drowned in the sea. Their herdsmen ran away and reported it in the city and in the country. And the people came to see what it was that had happened. They came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed sitting down, clothed and in his right mind, the very man who had had the legion, and they became frightened. Those who had seen it described it to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man and all about the swine. And they began to implore him to leave their region. As he was sitting in the boat, or as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was imploring him that he might accompany him. And he did not let him, but he said to him, 'Go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you.' And he went away and began to proclaim in Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him. And everyone was amazed." Just in case the scene is not uncomfortable enough for Jesus' disciples, we now find that the immediate area is swarming with swine. Pork was, of course, a forbidden food for the nation of Israel. Now, in some cultures, including Rome, swine was closely associated with idol worship and the demonic forces behind those idols. It was probably ancient Canaanite sacrificial practices that led to God determining that his people were prohibited from consuming swine. Way back in chapter 1 of his gospel, Mark made it clear to us that Jesus exercises complete dominion over the spiritual world. We just touched on that, remember? It should come as no surprise then when the legion of demons inhabiting this man bows down before Jesus, knowing they have no chance for survival in the presence of the Lord of the universe. They beg for mercy and asked to be sent into this nearby herd of pigs. Jesus, ever conscious of teaching the 12, permits the demons their request. And once again, at the literary center of this passage, Mark shines the spotlight on the point that he wants to emphasize, the point he really wants us to make sure we latch onto. And the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000, and they were drowned in the sea. Once again, we need to stop and ask, where have we seen this before? What is this evoking memories of? Well, how about Egypt? How about the Exodus? Nearly 1,500 years before, Israel's enemy rushed into the sea to pursue and recapture Israel. God closed the sea around them, and the armies of Pharaoh were destroyed that day. Once again, we see the enemies of Israel rush into the sea, plunging to its death. Only this time, Yahweh has taken it to a new and transcendent place. This time, it is not just the enemy of Israel, it is the enemy of all mankind. The strong man has been bound. He no longer has power. Let the plundering begin. But now we have to stop and ask, what does this mean? How does the plundering take place? What is the plunder? Let's look at the aftermath of the scene. First, we see the herdsmen in a panic. They do what we would all do, right? They run and tell somebody, you're not going to believe what just happened. People then gather and see for themselves this man who is possessed and is now free. Amazing. Or maybe not. Because their response is not one of rejoicing. It is one of fear. They asked Jesus to leave. They preferred their herds to a healed man. So Jesus, never one to force himself on people, quietly acquiesces and begins to leave. But before he does, Mark gives us this wonderful little detail. The man asks to come along, and Jesus responds, no. Go to your people and tell them what has happened. Now, there are some scholars who look at this journey across the lake as a missionary trip. And as such, some have determined that it was quite a failure. Only one man saved. I'd like to offer, however, that this was not just a missionary trip. This was war. This was a full-on assault on the gates of hell. And it was an enormous, enormous success. First, Jesus teaches his disciples that the enemy is not Rome. They will not be mounting an assault on Jerusalem in order to overthrow the oppressive Roman regime and restore Israel to earthly greatness. Secondly, they will find that the enemy is not that which is considered unclean, not the Romans, not the Gentiles in general, not society's outcasts. Satan is the enemy and all his hosts. Jesus not only defeats the evil one on his own turf, but he redeems the unclean. The unclean no longer spoils the clean. It is the clean who restores the unclean. In Jesus, the outcast of all outcasts is restored. Jesus takes the outcast, those who are deemed by society to be unworthy of being part of life, and he restores them. Now, what about that plunder? In Egypt, God bound the Egyptians, and he allowed Israel to take whatever of the Egyptian wealth they could possibly carry. He cared for his people by granting them the best of what the enemy had to offer before they left Egypt. Now, what about here? On the surface, it seems as though the only plunder worth having in this scene just took a flying leap off the cliff. And Israel doesn't want that anyway. So we have to fast forward a bit to Mark chapters 7 and 8 to get a glimpse. First, in chapter 7, verse 31, Mark tells us very matter-of-factly that Jesus has returned to Decapolis. He's gone back to the same area, right back to the place where he was thoroughly rejected and asked to leave. Jesus then proceeds to heal a deaf man, which is a metaphor for what's happening in this land. Then the full impact is revealed. You see, a multitude has gathered together with Jesus. And as with the multitude in chapter 6, Jesus feeds them in miraculous fashion. There are two miraculous feedings in Mark's account. Mark then tells us the result in verses 8 and 9 of chapter 8. Listen to this. And they ate and were satisfied, and they picked up 7 large baskets full of what was left over of the broken pieces, and about 4,000 were there. Do you see what's happened? The plunder is enormous. The strong man's household has been breached, and he has been bound. His house is now being plundered. The very best of his possession has been taken. In this case, 4,000. 4,000 captives have been set free because one man was released and he was commissioned to tell his story. See how important our stories are? One small mustard seed was planted. And as Ezekiel foretold, on the mountain heights of Israel, I will plant it, and it will produce branches and bear fruit and become a splendid cedar. Birds of every kind will nest in it. They will find shelter in the shade of its branches. Truly, birds of every kind are finding redemption, a hope, and a future in the branches of Messiah. The world of the disciples has been blown wide open on this trip. Jesus has reenacted the Exodus and taken the story to a whole new level. The one who can bind the strong man has arrived, and he will retrieve his plunder. The exiles will be restored. The Son of Man makes the unclean clean, and the true enemy has been redefined. It's not Rome and its legions. It's Satan and his minions. The enemy will be utterly destroyed by the Son of Man. He created with the Word. He will conquer with but a word. Chaos and the beast that it harbors will be set to rights. Out of confusion, order will be restored. And finally, seed will be planted not only in Israel, but in all nations, including the most unclean of the unclean. And from that seed will spring forth a new people, a new nation that transcends all boundaries. It's a nation of people plundered from the evil one who will rise up and give praise to the deliverer. And still more and more and more will come until the end of the age. Frankly, this is such a powerful passage. There's a part of me that hesitates to even go any further. But I do think we need to stop and reflect just a bit and consider how this lands in our own lives. Consider the impact on us. Now, I began our time together by posing the question, who is your enemy? Over whom do we expend unhealthy energy? Who generates angst in our lives and causes us to live with tension? I would offer that at the heart of who we perceive to be our enemies is fear. We fear what they can do to us, how they can influence us, our lives and the lives of those we love. Our enemies become our enemies because they oppose what we desire, threaten what we hold as important, and encroach on our comfort zone. Jesus wants to redefine our enemies. He longs to give us a new vision into the heart of the matter. He longs to help us to see into the hearts of those we fear and oppose. I have to confess to you that in spite of the fact that I work with kids all the time, I often find myself in a critical and condescending place with teens that I don't know. I found myself at times intolerant and judgmental of the wildness of youth and the indiscretions that are part of growing up and discovering one's identity. Just last week, I came steaming out of my house after observing a high school senior who lives around the corner, screeching around the corner in his Honda, a little four-wheel drift going on, tires squealing, engine roaring. In our neighborhood, there are no less than 8 small children under the age of about 7. So I grabbed my somewhat perplexed neighbor, Rob, in part for backup and in part so that I didn't tear the kid's head off. And I said, "Rob, we're going to go have a little talk with our neighbor." Rob could see that I meant business. So he put the wood down, turned the saw off, and he joined me. Now, fortunately, we had a little bit of a walk around the corner because it gave me just a couple of minutes to talk with Rob and reflect a little bit and remember that this is just a kid. He's just trying to figure out who he is, trying to make his way in the world, find himself, figure out his identity. And more importantly, screeching four-wheel drifts in our neighborhood notwithstanding, Jesus loves this young man and wants to plunder him from the enemy. Oh, yeah. He's not the enemy. Satan is the enemy. And Jesus wants to redeem my young neighbor. Well, I can't say that a whole lot of redemptive work went on during our meeting. At least none that I was involved with. But I didn't blast him. I made sure that he knew that there was to be no more performance driving in the neighborhood, but I didn't blast him. I did remember that he's not the enemy, and I did not treat him as such. Small victory. Small victory. Who's our enemy? Are we willing to look past the facade to the things of which we are afraid? The things we consider unclean, are we willing to look past them to see the broken, fearful prisoner struggling to find himself, to make his way in the world? Satan wants to deceive us into thinking that people are the enemy. If he succeeds, then we will not notice the reality. Our enemies need Jesus desperately, just like we need Jesus. Will we be agents of grace and mercy, or will we be agents of judgment and anger? He's called us to join the plunder. We too can join in plundering the enemy of his best possessions. In the ancient world, the sea was often a symbol of chaos and evil. Jesus deals with the forces of hell by burying them in what symbolizes their dominion. Now, amazingly, we see parallels between the possessed man and Jesus himself. Both end up naked out among the tombs of the dead, torn apart by the forces of evil. Both are buried and restored to life. But unlike the demon-possessed man, Jesus takes the burial himself, doesn't he? And unlike the demons, Jesus rises from the depths, conquering the evil that put him there. You see, it is into this burial and resurrection that we have been baptized. How can we then go forward with judgment and disdain when we have been given life? We are certainly not called to condone evil. It's good and right to call evil for what it is. But more important than that, we are called to reach the captives, to be a part of God's great work in setting the captives free. Jesus rebuked his disciples for not having more faith. And I'm convinced that it was not so much for lack of faith as it was to deepen them, like a coach at halftime driving his team to greater heights. Jesus is calling us to be bold, to have greater faith, to take risks. The disciples themselves were later to take on the forces of hell and face evil. And Jesus was readying them for the awesome battles to come. He's called us to the same. Jesus has called us to make disciples of the nations. He's called us to make disciples right here in Silicon Valley. Are we treating the enemies or retreating as enemies, the very ones Jesus wishes to redeem? Or are we looking beneath and seeing the true enemy who's been defeated? Amen.